May it please the court.
May I proceed?
Lou Horwitz on behalf of the defendant, Kirk Jackson. The issue before the court today is the constitutionality of cash-only bail under Article 1, Section 20 of the Missouri Constitution. Said section states that all persons shall be bailable by sufficient sureties except for capital offenses. The legal issue, the context for this legal issue is as follows. When the initial warrant has been served on a defendant, defendant has been admitted to bail, a capital offense is not charged, and the defendant has not posted bond. As framed, we submit that cash-only bail in that context is unconstitutional for the reasons stated in the brief.
How does Article 1, Section 32 modify that, or if at all?
At this stage, it's simply not relevant. It puts the cart before the horse. I can respond to that further.
Sure, go ahead.
But at this stage, as the issue has been framed, when the defendant has been admitted to bail, the warrant has been served, and he has not posted bond, there's under that provision, under 32.2 of the Constitution, one, it's a separate, it's not part of Section 20's bail provision. It's separate in the Crime Victims' Rights section, but it rests upon a showing. A showing has to be made, and no such showing has been made or was made to the trial court. It's simply not before the court.
What if the court finds in the facts presented that additional, that security of the public or others requires it? I mean, what doesn't require some particular showing, but just the court find that's necessary?
Right. If that showing is made or found under 32.2, it then says there are two options. The trial court may deny bail outright, which would moot the cash only concern with that, or the court may set conditions which the defendant and the surety must agree. So it implies that a surety must be involved, meaning that cash only is not even an option if Article 1, Section 32.2 were found to be applied. And under the authority in the state's cases, depositor of cash only bail by definition cannot be a surety.
So you're saying that in no situation could a judge order a cash only bail?
It depends on if the person's still in jail, if they've been unable to post. For example, if they post the bond, then it's moot. They've posted the bond, they're not going to question the legality of it.
What if at a traffic stop, law enforcement decides to go ahead, in lieu of issuing a summons for a speeding ticket, decides to arrest the individual, which they could, and the judge sets a cash-only bond at $10?
Right.
Is that unconstitutional?
That's a good question, and as framed for the technical point of how it's written in Rule 3301 and how it would apply to that, I think for that limited purpose, unless they're going to redraft Rule 3301, I think as drafted.
Well, the rules and the statute both have to comply with the Constitution, all the constitutional
yes.
provisions.
I would
so,
say.
So, but your argument that a cash-only bond is always unconstitutional. You stick with that if the officer decides to make an arrest on a speeding ticket and set the bond at $10 cash only, that's unconstitutional?
Not as framed as I framed it. If the defendant posts the bail, then
well, assume he doesn't have the $10 on him. He's on his motorcycle.
Right.
He
yes.
doesn't have any cash with him.
Yes, the answer would be yes, our position is it's unconstitutional.
But because one of the key reasons you suggest it's unconstitutional is that it, in effect, can be used to deny bail because you set a cash bond. But isn't that really an argument that it's excessive, that if you're setting a cash bond, it should be less?
Yes, that's what State v. or X. Rel. Miles states, and that's cited in the brief that goes to, that this right is a right that which cannot be denied to a defendant. And if bail is set so high that it has the effect that the defendant cannot furnish it, then it's the equivalent of that.
But there's sort of two different arguments. One is that there's nothing necessarily unconstitutional about a cash bail. It's simply not permitted under Missouri's Constitution as written. And the second is that to the extent that cash bail, I see you're arguing, or bond is used often to really prevent people from being bailable. And if that's a misuse of an authorized use of a, like the $10 one would not have that problem, clearly, or a $100 one or whatever. But that's a different argument, which I think you're saying the excessiveness issue is not being raised.
It is part, right. The excessiveness is not strictly before the court, but that the issue with that is also part of how to answer this question.
Go ahead.
In terms of the that constitutionality of it, if it's where the defendant cannot furnish it, we're saying that you don't go to the excessive bail clause claim or to borrow from those principles at this stage.
But to the extent your argument is that it's unconstitutional because it in effect keeps people in jail and the purpose of the bond requirement is to secure their appearance.
Correct.
It's really an excessiveness argument that when it's cash you can't make it $10,000 or $100,000, whereas if you only have to put up 10%, you can.
Right. It may be we would just respectfully disagree with that characterization of it, but the ultimate purpose is under Missouri's law, Stexel State ex rel Miles is so that the purpose of bail is so the defendant can appear in court, and to the extent that it deprives him of that right, whether it's cash only or excessive,
right.
He's been denied the right.
What if the defendant chooses, let's say it's a $75,000 bond in this case, regardless of what the means are of the people who are defendant, what if the defendant chooses to put $75,000 cash in the registry of the court, and if they don't appear, they forfeit that money. Why shouldn't they be able to do that? What's the rationale to say you can't put $75,000 cash by your own choice in the registry of the court to ensure your attendance, or you have to go to an insurance company or a bail bondsman instead? Why can't you, regardless of whether or not the judge says cash only, well, if you put $75,000, is that not meeting the purpose for bail bond? You put $75,000 in your own cash. If you don't show, it's forfeited. That's why it's there to ensure that you will appear.
Oh yes, that's I believe it's.
But there's no third party.
Right.
You just say here's $75,000. If I don't appear, I forfeit it.
Right, but I believe as the court stated that there was it sounded like there was an option for the defendant in that instance that he could post the $75,000 if he wanted to, or use the surety.
But what that's contrary to what you're arguing. You're saying under the Constitution, a person has to have a surety, and you're defining that surety as a third person. So under Judge Teitelman's scenario, they would not have properly posted a bond because they don't have a third party surety.
In that scenario, yes.
Does that make sense? So you can't, I mean, it's not supposed to be a bail bondsman full employment constitutional provision. It's
right.
To secure their appearance in court. And in fact, when it was first written, there weren't commercial bail bondsmen. So it can't have meant you have to use that kind of surety.
Right. I think it depends on how you define surety and sufficient sureties.
In the brief, you define surety as formal engagement as a pledge given for the fulfillment of an undertaking, citing Merriam-Webster. Why
yes.
does cash not meet that definition?
I think it does, but there's more than one definition or
uh-huh.
for
and
all
that
these,
happens
all
in
these
many terms that
right.
we're required to interpret.
Yes.
And there are alternative definitions, and if one matches and makes sense and seems the reasonable interpretation, why doesn't that answer the question for us?
Because it goes to, if the person's not released, it frustrates the intent under the rule in the Constitution.
Well, that's an excessive bond issue, which is different than the constitutional issue of the form of the bond, correct? I mean, there would be two separate issues. And for example, the judge, what if the judge set this case at $750,000 bond, and or sufficient sureties, and so he had to pay $75,000 to a bondsman, you'd be saying, well, this is excessive.
Correct.
It doesn't require. So that's a whole separate issue. The issue I think that's really before us is this issue that you raise as to whether or not something other than a surety or what the definition of surety is. Another common scenario that concerns me about your argument, and I want to put it out there so that you can think about it if you haven't, is what if somebody has real estate free and clear, and the bond is set at $25,000, and all he has to do is pledge his real estate as opposed to paying a bondsman, and he knows it's there, it's unused equity. Why shouldn't he be allowed to do that? And the way I read your argument is that's not a surety. I mean, if cash isn't a surety, then surely property isn't a surety.
Right, and to the extent relevant, case law in other foreign jurisdictions points out just that argument, that if cash only is allowed, what about property only? How doesn't that raise the same issues? And we submit that, yes, that if that argument is allowed, if cash only is found to be constitutional, then property only would be found to be constitutional. But if the person's not released, and if he's denied access through a surety of some form,
This case involved 14 different counts, and isn't there some value to giving a trial court judge a certain amount of discretion in establishing what form the bond or the bail should be in? The trial court judge is better aware of maybe the defendant's asset situation, if he owns real estate or if he has cash. Or why shouldn't we review this with a real careful discretion given to the trial court and what form they pick?
I agree.
And so under this situation with 14 different counts and the trial court judge being right there in person, knowing more about the defendant than we do, why shouldn't we affirm his decision?
Well, if the court's referring to the decision that's properly before the court where the bond was set when the cash-only bond was set when the warrant was issued, I believe that's the issue that's before the court. That's a question of law. So even if the trial court, if there was a ruling to that effect.
It's a question of law that we've never said a surety requires a third party.
Right.
And so you're asking us to go into some new area, create some new law.
Right, but I think the reverse of that also, it's just by the fact that it's in use, just because cash only has been in use, there still needs to be authority for it under the rules and Constitution.
Did you file a motion to modify the terms of the bond, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so why doesn't that then, you keep saying the issue as framed, so I'm not exactly sure what you mean by that, so you might give me some help there, but to me, since you filed a motion to modify the terms of the bond, that would then open it up to the trial court to do whatever they thought was reasonable under the Constitution, the statutes, and the rules. In other words, the trial court wouldn't necessarily only have to look at the options you provide in your motion. There's a plethora of options that a trial court might look at to assure the attendance, but at the same time, allow some reasonable bond.
Oh, yes, I agree.
So when you say the issue is framed, I mean, when you file a motion to modify the terms of the bond, whether to allow the posting of 10% cash only or a surety or property or whatever, why doesn't, when you file your motion, the trial court then have the discretion to consider everything that you suggest, the state suggests, or everything that the trial court might assume on its own has been worked in the past?
It does.
Okay.
That's my understanding.
Any more questions at this time? You'll have time for rebuttal.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court? I think one of the starting points I'd like to make is a big distinction in how we interpret the Constitution and the interplay of the articles in question here. Article 1, Section 20 and Article 32.2, my position is you read these together, you read these consistent together, and they both apply to the case from the very start of the case. We've cited one case from Missouri which talks about how these are applicable from the very start of the case, even before the charges are filed, and that's In re Conard. That was a disciplinary case before this court, but it revolved around the setting of a bond and a judge trying to set a recognizance bond before the charges had been filed while someone was in custody under 20-hour hold at that time. And the court made it clear, these provisions apply even before the charges are filed in the case. So that's something to consider. These must be read together and harmonized. And these two provisions, when you read them together, the first one shows a provision, an intent that the bond should be set so it's adequate so that the person will return so the case can be resolved with that person's presence. And the second one, Section 32, it's designed to make sure that we also protect the community and the victim from hazards that may occur from the person running free on bond.
Your opponent argues that the language in Article 1, Section 32.2 supports his interpretation of Article 1, Section 20 because it uses the word and between defendant and surety, so that indicates the intention in adopting the Constitution that there must always be a surety.
Special conditions which the defendant must guarantee by saying, I promise I'll show up, and the surety must guarantee. If you look at the cases, one of the definitions of surety is cash. Cash is the surety. That's what's designed to get you to show up.
How is that so? Where's the definition of surety that says that?
The definition of surety is in, which case was that?
State v. Eccles says that,
Cash
can act as a surety and adopts the approach taken in New York and says the law looks to the money as surety for the appearance of the defendant rather than to the physical surety.
That's right.
Would that have applied without regard to 32.2, though? Or are you saying that cash could only be surety once the victim's rights provisions were adopted?
When you look at the cases that are cited by the parties, they're split as to, you know, most of these different states, they have our Article 1, Section 20 in their Constitution. And the other provisions they're citing to moderate it are statutes and rules which can't be used to dilute it. And even with those statutes and rules which can't dilute it, you know, most of them are reaching the same position that we're reaching.
So if we take that definition, of surety, then saying it'd be a cash bond would say there's sufficient surety in that the judge is just defining what the surety is. It has to be cash.
And if
that's the case, then that's a surety.
And then you go into a different section of the Constitution, which is our excessive bails provision. You know, is this a sufficient surety under the facts of the case with the judge knowing all that's happened in the case? And you know, when they originally said it, they have the charges to look at. They have the PC statement. And in this case, we've had two bond hearings. You know,
but that's a different issue from whether a cash bond is a surety or not. Is it excessive or not? Then that's a different. Maybe you should set it higher. Maybe put conditions on the bond.
You can't
come near the victims. Whatever.
It's a surety, but it may go to the question of whether it's a sufficient surety.
And don't we run the risk? And I think opposing counsel's arguments kind of go to this: that appellate courts are very deferential to trial courts in the setting of bond amounts. And so, if you say, "Well, cash bond is fine," I don't think you find very many cases where an appellate court said, well, you set $50,000 or $100,000, that was really intended to keep them in prison, not to assure their appearance if we let them out. So how do we, as a practical matter, police that if we were to agree with you and say cash bond is okay?
Most of the times, when we're talking about this, a lot of our cash bonds, you know, are designed to keep them in prison. A lot of times it's designed. This is a commonly used thing. We're talking about some of these small bonds. Many times what they're used for, it's like it's a bad check case. And you know, the check was a $500 check, and the person doesn't show up, and the judge says, set the bond at $500. That will be designed to get them to appear. And we have got the side benefit. We've got the restitution there. There's something there for attorney to put a lien on to pay for it. So I want to emphasize that it's not just used in this context to keep people
Because that would be a misuse of it, wouldn't
right.
it be, to keep them from making bail?
Depends how dangerous they are. If they're truly dangerous, that's not a misuse. And if they're truly dangerous, and if you say cash bond is unconstitutional, the court can go, okay, I can't set a cash bond. Bond is set at $10 million. Property allowed, surety, commercial surety allowed.
But the purpose allowed. Of bail is not to keep them in prison unless you just, because if you thought they were dangerous to let out, what you should do is say, is make findings that justify not releasing them.
They can make findings not to release a fine, and they can completely deny bond. That's very true. And then it's one of these things that you will have to, if you're going to police this closely, I mean, it is something that would keep this court very busy. I don't think this is something this court wants to spend most of its time with.
Good assumption.
Maybe the court.
And plus, the public defender, if you can't pay bond, well, I don't know what this rule, the rule is, if you can't pay bond, then you can get a public defender. So it'll be another burden on the public defender system.
I don't know if that's how they get public defenders. Public defenders, it's more than that. They go look at your property and your access to property.
It's one of the listed
factors.
If you get
bond, you can't get a public defender.
It is part of the factor, but it's more complicated than that.
It used to be, but right now it's only one of the factors. It's not dispositive any longer.
Right. But, and your thing to keep in mind is right now there are a lot of cases where we do cash-only bonds. And they're low bonds, and people can come in and meet those low bonds. And if we have to, if people have to think about, well, it's a property bond, the surety, let me make the bond higher, and then they can't make the surety. And then what happens? Then they're locked away, they lose their job, they can't afford the attorney, we're back in the public defender system.
Well, you're also guaranteeing you lose 10%, whereas if you get the cash bond and you show up, you get it all back.
Right.
But the 10%
now that you get
bond,
all back, that money can be given to pay your restitution and for useful purposes.
But the 10% bond to a bondsman, they don't put cash in the... They don't put cash in the registry of the court. They just say, well, bring them in.
It's a bond.
That's not a cash.
No.
There's no cash at all.
There's a significant advantage to the cash bonds, especially in the misdemeanor cases, I've really noticed. Yes, sir.
Also, well, my concern is it says sufficient sureties are, if we're not going to allow cash-only bonds, how are we going to educate the trial judges on what insurance companies are currently in financial status sufficient to cover their obligations,
right.
Especially those that deal other than in bonds.
Right.
Hail. I mean, AIG probably wrote bonds.
Right.
I mean, so sufficient sureties. Are we going to have to educate all the trial judges on what insurance companies are sufficient sureties to meet the obligation?
And if the only reason to say no cash bond is because you're afraid that the courts are going to set that too high, I mean, there's other types of bonds. There's other ways to get around that. If they think someone is truly dangerous after hearing the facts and this person should not be out because of the threat they pose to other people, there are ways for them to do it without a cash-only bond. But a cash-only bond is really useful in cases, especially, I think especially the smaller cases. We get involved in the facts of this case, you know, where we've got the 14 counts charged in this county, and we've had bond hearings where, you know, things have gone through, which we won't go into at this time. But it's something which, it's not very susceptible to appellate review, you know, on a large-scale basis. And I don't know if this court wants to be in that business. Are there any further facts that the questions court has for me? I just want to point out Missouri is one of the only states I know of that has, you know, we have our Article 1, Section 20, and most of the states have that. The other states that we're looking at in the briefs, you know, that they have something that's similar to Article 1, Section 32, but it's not in their Constitution. Ours is in our Constitution, and that's why it modifies Article 1, Section 20, and why that doesn't for the other states.
The other states kind of split on whether or not cash-only bond is permissible under a provision like Article 1, Section 20. Where do they diverge? How come half of them go one way and half the other?
Well, the reason that they divert is some of them are, say, we have this, we think it's super important for us to have commercial sureties being available. If you don't have a commercial surety available, then it's an excessive bond. And the other cases are going, there's no constitutional protection to any form of surety. It's just that there'd be reasonable access to certain types of sureties. And as long as you have access to you can try the cash yourself, you can have other sources of sureties coming from, you know, your relatives, your grandparents, sometimes employers come up with cash, sometimes it's, you know, baby's mama comes up with cash. And then the issue for those ones is it's not the form, it's the amount. Is it excessive? If it gets to be too much cash.
That gets to the sufficiency point.
Right.
Yeah. If only professional sureties are allowed, then the amount of cash it actually takes to get somebody out is left up to the integrity of the bondsman, not the court, correct? Because everybody's working on an assumption that they're only going to charge 10%, but they evaluate the risk just like the judge does as to whether or not the person will show up.
And some bondsmen don't even take cash. I've seen bondsmen which say, you will work for me for 6 months while you're out doing various jobs for me, and I will bond you out.
And back to the most prevalent use of cash-only bonds on the small misdemeanor cases, the DWIs and so forth. Do you know what the practice is as far as bondsmen? Do they often charge more than 10% to post the smaller bonds?
I don't know what the practice is. I've seen 10% bonds. I've seen no cash at all involved. I've seen people make payment plans to bondsmen, you know, so it's not now, and it's you know, $10 a month for who knows how long. But I'm not involved in that.
Does he always have the option to produce the defendant back to jail? In other words, just because he's been released, does the bondsman contract allow him to just
if he thinks the defendant's getting too hot and he doesn't want to take the risk, I don't know. I'd have to look at their contract on that. Mm-hmm. I imagine it might vary as to what they sign on.
But at that point, it's the agreement between the bondsman and the defendant. There's no court involved,
is
there?
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, are you arguing that $75,000 is too much?
No. That's not before the court, just the issue of cash
only. So the sufficiency is not the issue.
Correct.
It's the surety.
Okay. It's just cash only. And this is really about equal justice under law. As we've heard today, the various arguments and competing arguments for trying to justify it or against it, as it's framed, it's not before the court at this stage. It is relevant, but as it's framed right now...
So you argue against the Eccles case. Cash cannot be surety.
No, Eccles actually supports our case that a cash only...
Permits a cash... It doesn't deal with the constitutional issue, but
right.
It permits a cash only bond.
Right, but it also says...
But it adopts the rationale of the New York, of the cases that say it's constitutional because it defines surety to include the cash acting as surety for the appearance of the defendant. While it didn't address it in constitutional terms, that's the rationale the courts that have approved it constitutionally have used, didn't it?
Yeah, yes, but it does also say that a depositor of cash bail cannot be a surety.
It says that if you're going to do cash only, it has to be the defendant's money because it's defendant's cash.
Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. And that there is a case, Fragoso in Arizona, where they actually did modify their state constitution in the same provision, like Article 1, Section 20 of our constitution. They amended theirs and specifically addressed the purpose of bail.
What happens if you're right that cash-only bonds are not allowed and there's no surety because of something about the particular defendant that anybody will post? How does the Constitution protect that defendant?
I don't know, but that's the essence here, is that the Constitution, Article 1, does say all persons shall be bailable by sufficient sureties except for capital offenses. So excluding that one constitutional exception.
Well, I understand that. I'm saying that a judge sets a bond for an individual at $15,000, and it's not a capital offense, but that this person is sufficiently dangerous or sufficiently a flight risk that he cannot find a surety to post the bond, and the judge says, nope, I'm not taking your money. I want somebody besides you on the line. I want somebody else I can answer to. If you don't allow a cash-only bond, then that person is left to the mercy of the commercial bonding industry, correct?
Yes, but he's had that
so
option.
I'm saying if it's his only option.
If it's his only option, yes.
And so if a judge set a bond and said surety only, you think that that somehow has more constitutional protection than being allowed to post cash?
Well, my understanding of your question is that it also assumes that the person's not going to be released, that no bondsman's going to touch his
correct.
Bond.
Correct, correct.
That the Constitution still then has to accommodate that person's interest, as what the holding was of Briggs is, that they found and they used the situation where a person failed to appear. My question would be, how would Briggs have ruled differently in our procedural posture? Mm-hmm. If that were the case, if those facts were different, would Briggs have ruled differently? But the intent is still to release under the Constitution and Rule 3301. That's the clear wording of the rules we have, and unless and until those are modified to reflect what we want, that's the way it is.
I have to disagree with you on Eccles. Eccles, the reason they wouldn't let the third party put up the cash is because the third party was not willing to act as surety, and they were not trying to act as surety. They simply wanted to give the defendant the money, and the court said, basically, if it's not the defendant's money, defendant doesn't care. They're just going to walk. It has to be defendant's money, so defendant has the vested interest in the security for his appearance. That didn't address whether a third party could put up 10% or 20% or say, I'll act as surety, and a court could accept a non-commercial surety. That just wasn't addressed.
No, I agree, but it still, ECCL still does not answer the question of constitutionality of cash-only bail as framed.
Well, it does, but it doesn't conclude. But it's kind of interesting because the general practice, as I understand it, is that no matter who puts up the money, in the end, it is the defendant's money. So the money is not necessarily released to the third party, grandma or cousin or brother. It's released upon the defendant's say-so to whom the defendant says. So it becomes the defendant's cash. Isn't that correct in the state of Missouri?
I'm not at liberty to answer that, but I think there is argument supporting that, but it goes to, I think, a comment that Mr. Burgess mentioned. Well, it depends on the forms that are signed, and each county has different...
Right. Some judges will not allow a third person to post cash,
right.
But some judges do. Is that your understanding?
Yes, yes.
Could you address Judge Stitt's question as to the other jurisdictions, the split in the jurisdictions where some with similar, when they have similar constitutional provisions, the rationale for saying it does not include a cash-only bond?
My understanding is you got two schools of thought, Brooks and Briggs. And each one of them, the opinions really didn't give much attention to the rules, but they're the strongest support for ruling the way that they want to rule was based on the interpretation of sufficient sureties. One school thought, interpret that sufficient gives the court's discretion to do what they want to do. Brooks argues the converse of that it's not limited. Sufficient sureties is a term that's interpreted broadly. And the cases that support those, some of the rules at issue in those cases that are in the briefs are also different from the rules that we have. So you have, there's one case, State v. Hance, that in their rules had a discrete condition for cash-only bond. They said, yes, cash-only is allowed under the rules, but to the extent that it's not constitutional because it violates what we interpret our state constitution to be. The other schools of thought are that the opinions that support cash only, they go, well, it's if the framers intended cash only to be prohibited, they would have said so. The others take the position that if cash only had intended to be authorized, the framers would have said so. So it's pick your poison, which school of thought.
Well,
you
how do you interpret that? These provisions came into effect in some states in the 1820s, 1830s, before there were really commercial sureties, so they could not have been referring to you have to go find a bondsman and have the bondsman put up surety. What did they mean?
Well, that's what I've outlined in the brief, that I went back and found the law that before Missouri was admitted to the Union, there was the law governing the territory of Missouri. It just specifically said all persons shall be bailable. The clear intent of that is you're out.
Yeah, but by how? How do you get out when there's no such thing as a commercial bondsman?
Right, but the intent is there that they'll work on the mechanics or logistics of it, but their intent.
But a lot of states, whether Missouri did or not, a lot of states did have these provisions like Section 20.
Right.
Prior to Missouri, I know you said didn't get it till like the 1875 Constitution. Some had it earlier. I don't know if there were bondsmen at that time or not, but there certainly it was adopted in many states where there were not bondsmen. So how did people get out?
Well, actually, I've shown in the brief, by definition, bondsmen, you know, by the dictionaries that were in use and available that predated ours, by terms, bondsmen did exist. And that there's
so everybody
not,
got out by a commercial bondsman, and it's never been any other method, you're telling
no,
us?
No, I'm not saying that. The brief also
you
notes that there's not much information in the history of all this to go on, but we can infer, based on the fact that by definition, bondsmen did exist, whether they're at the extent, as Briggs points out, whether it's really not, it's still an emerging process is open to debate, and I simply don't have an answer for that. But I think
that
there's...
Well, I'm just suggesting that if that commercial bondsmen were not a settled procedure for people posting bail,
right.
That then how can we interpret that provision to mean you can only use a bondsman? When that clearly was not the only mechanism back at that time.
Right, the concern is so that you don't use cash only. Not to only use a bondsman, but the concern is cash only. Do we want cash only or do we not at this stage of the proceedings? Not when somebody's failed to appear on bond and like Briggs.
If we look back at the historical aspects, then surety meaning I'll take the place of that person. So do you think that's still constitutional? That
if it's surety only?
Well, it's sufficient surety. As I understood some of the historical context was that somebody would actually say, if they don't show up, you could put me in jail until they get there.
Right.
You think that's what's... In 1875, you think that's what was intended at that time?
As long as they had the option to experience equal justice like everyone else, in terms of all persons shall be bailed except for capital offenses. Now, however that's worded, or at the times or the customs 100, 200 years ago, I don't know.
Well, thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.